This is Sean Ferguson with the Oral History Summer School with Brian DeWan. The date is June 5th, 2013. And Brian, if you would, you can introduce yourself.
Well, my name is Brian DeWan. We're sitting here in the studio in the voiceover room in Hudson, New York. I just have to ask you some questions now. Do you just want me to go? Are we going to converse, or do you want me to just talk? Or
I'm going to ask you a few questions.
Oh, okay.
And, all right. You just take it from there.
Right.
Would you like to start with tell me about where you grew up?
Well, I grew up in Lexington, Massachusetts, and I had a lot of fun there growing up. Never moved. Was there until I was 18. And still have a lot of pals that I grew up with who are scattered here and there. But we had a lot of fun together in the old neighborhood. We'd sit around and draw and make up stuff and mess around. There was one point when it looked like my father was going to have to be moved to this other lab in Albuquerque. He was an Air Force guy. He was a physicist, worked at Hanscom Air Base in Bedford, Mass. So he was out of a job for a little while in 72, and we were going to maybe all move to some disused barracks in Albuquerque. And I can remember my mother saying years later, looking back, saying, "Well, I said to your dad, you know, you can go down there if you want, but me and the kids are staying here." And then he ended up getting a job at a different organization on the same air base. So he worked there his whole life. We went to St. Bridget's Catholic Church. My brother and I were altar boys there when we were kids, up until when we were teenagers. Not long ago, I saw one of the priests from that church at a funeral. And when I was a kid, he was the young, groovy 60s priest. And it was funny to see him again so many years later. And he was very much recognizable as himself. Though I told him about how I remembered Father Crowley, who was one of the priests there. He was conducting like basement mass early in the morning. My brother and I went to serve mass, and in the winter, it's still pitch dark before school, the 7 a.m. mass, and that day was a particularly icy day, and usually just a handful of elderly people showed up to these church basement masses, and nobody was there. There was no congregation. So Father Crowley turned to my brother and I and said, "Well, looks like nobody will be coming." And then he said the whole mass. We did the whole thing. There was no congregation at all. So I told this to Father Coletti and how I never forgot about it. So then he tells me a story. He says, "Oh, once we were doing this outdoor mass in Maine, we had this flatbed truck for the altar. And then this Cardinal so-and-so showed up." And he says, "Oh, the Cardinal, he's the big man." So there's just a handful of people there for the mass, and the cardinal says, "Where is everybody?" And then Father Coletti said to him, "Well, Cardinal, this is an Italian congregation, and the men sit up on the hill over there and drink wine, and they send their wives and children down here to listen to us in case it's all true." So that was great to see him again. I even had this conversation with him where I told him about how the whole idea of being old and in the way was alien to me growing up, because there were all these 80-year-olds around kicking everyone's ass. And he said, "Well, they were pioneers. People today, they're soft." And so I got a kick out of hearing this sentiment expressed by the groovy 60s priest. Well, he told me how Father Crowley had used to work for Lincoln Labs, which was a lab that was kind of part of the whole Hanscom Field complex there. And so he was more an engineer or something. And Sometime in his middle age, he left that work and went to the seminary, became a priest. So Father Coletti was a kind of mentor to him in seminary, even though he was the much younger man, but they just had an unhierarchical friendship and ended up being assigned to the same church. So interesting to see him after so many years.
How did you feel when you saw him?
Oh, it was so interesting how different he was and how the same he was. But there's just so many more chapters in a person's life by then. I could kind of pick up on it. And he was very on the level. Yeah, strange to run into him like that. And the house I grew up in was gone a long time ago, so I hadn't really been back there very much. So it was funny to go back to the familiar place that's not so familiar anymore. And some things had changed beyond recognition, and other things were exactly the same as they always were. There's also a guy who was my sixth grade teacher who, after many years, I was in touch with again, and we became friends, and he lives in Lowell, Mass. And he said, he was teaching adult education courses and singing in a Greek Orthodox church choir. I said to him, well, for someone who's retired, you got a pretty busy schedule. And he said, yeah, but the difference is now I get to do what I want to do.
So before you mentioned the house you grew up in, could you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, that house was, I think I found out it was built in 1941 when we were scraping wallpaper off of a plaster wall, and somebody had written that with a grease pencil right on the plaster. And I can remember later when the house was being sold, the realtor claimed it was built in 1949, just to make it feel a little newer, I guess. So it was an early 40s ranch house. It had some funny details, like it was traditional in many ways, but some other things that were kind of supposed to be modern. So there was a fireplace that had this thing that looked like a keystone that was made out of wood, and then this mantle that stuck out of it. But I remember my parents were concerned that the corners were going to, brain somebody coming into the front door, because you walk in and there are these corners jutting out into the room. So they, cut it off. And then at some point they added something onto it. So then it was like a split level. It had those kind of 1940s metal casing windows that you crank some windows out on this little crank. And I remember one little area where my father had hacksawed through it to put an air conditioner in that was too big for the window frame. And we had this wonderful organ that was a three-manual electric church model organ that was my father's that he got in 1960. And he played, and my brother and I both grew up playing. It had rotating speakers, which is not the same thing as what's also called a Leslie cabinet, although it amounts to the same thing. So these speakers could spin at different speeds and whirl the sound around, which is a really mesmerizing thing and something that isn't really made anymore. It might still exist. I think the Leslie company must still exist. But it was great to grow up with this, and it was such a big influence in my life. Now it would be considered obsolete, but it's a great instrument. But like so many things that are considered obsolete, it isn't really obsolete. Certainly not as an instrument. It's very unwieldy because you could, accomplish so much more with so much, less with modern electronics. So these were early solid-state electronics. Unwieldy thing to move. Yeah, at some point in his life, my father got into organ music, I think, when he was a teenager, and he was particularly interested in, you know, modern French organ composers like Messiaen or Jean Alain, who isn't that well known, but I think is probably better appreciated now, who wrote a lot of really wonderful kind of out there harmonically music for organ, sometimes with religious themes, but modern, very colorful harmonies. Many years later, I found out, or I saw some drawings that he had done. And he died when he was very young in World War II. I think he was 29 when he died. But during his life, he wrote all this really cool keyboard music. Later, I found out about a bunch of choral music he did. You know, it's always exciting when, if there's an artist that you love and you think that there's just this small, finite amount of stuff, and then you discover later there's this whole other bunch of stuff for you to feast on.
So you mentioned your father and your brother a lot, but could you tell me a little bit more about your mother?
Yeah. Well, my mother was from Boston, and her whole side of the family is Boston, Irish, Catholic. And she grew up in Dorchester, and then, you know, met my father when she was a freshman in college. She went to Radcliffe, which, as she explained to me, was really Harvard, but they wouldn't admit that they were admitting women, so that there was no such thing as a women's college that was called Radcliffe. It was just a bunch of dorms with a name on it, and that it was this bogus thing. I mean, she told me about how she went to a reunion and didn't like that some guy running things said, "Oh, I see that the Radcliffe contingent is here." And she said to the guy, "I'm not a Radcliffe student. I'm a transgendered Harvard student." And then she said, and then he looked at me like he was scanning me for signs of masculinity, and then I realized he thought I was serious. You know, I can remember when we were kids, there was a couple of kids who lived down the street who were maybe about 5 years older than my brother and I, and they were always kind of up to some sort of hell-raising. And can remember about, I was probably 5 years old when they were over and opened a dresser drawer and were pointing into it, pointing at a pile of underwear and laughing at the underwear. And my mother saw them and said, "Why don't you go to a department store? Then you can laugh your head off." Sometime when I was a little kid, my mother made me a VW bug cake and sculpted a cake to look like a Volkswagen bug. Goodness gracious. Yeah, it was important to her that we grow up in the church, even though in many ways she was maybe not a conventional Catholic, or would refer to what she called Catholic damaged families. But I can remember before we were altar boys, sitting next to my mother in church and the priest giving the reading about the prodigal son. And the prodigal son returns and the younger son says, "But I've been loyal to you all these years and you have never given my friends and I so much as a kid goat, and yet you killed the fatted calf for him." The father says, "What, he was lost, now he is found." And I can remember my mother leaning over and saying to me, "Now, I don't buy that. I think it's great that he welcomed back the prodigal son, but the younger son got ripped off." My mother's father came to live at our house after my grandmother died. And so I saw a lot of him, and he was full of stories. And they were wonderful, fragmented stories. My brother Ted surreptitiously tape-recorded him for maybe a certain number of 90-minute cassettes, and after he died, he listened to them and edited them together and made copies of them for various people in the extended family. So I'm really glad that he did that. And to hear those, usually one would kind of bleed into another. I remember there was one story that he would tell about the singing oven. He worked at a Sunshine Biscuit plant in Boston, and he was a floor supervisor there, and he said he had heard for such a long time about, he says, all the old-time bakers called it the singing oven. And you've been hearing about this. He says, well, damned if I wasn't going to find out what this singing oven was all about. So he goes to the floor where the singing oven is, and he says, sure enough, they're loading the pans into the lowerators, and there's this noise coming out of it going, and so after the shift was over and the machinery is shut down, he said, I got up there into the chimney, and there's this axle there, and you know, sure enough, when I started the motor on it, those bearings were squeaking, going, woo-woo-woo-woo. I got up there with an oil can. After that, bam, no more singing oven. So he had all sorts of stories in that vein. Once he told me a story about getting on the bus. He was working as a volunteer for the Evelyn Murphy for Mayor campaign. I guess this was in the 80s. And he had a volunteer button on, Evelyn Murphy for Mayor of Boston. And a woman came up to him on the bus and said, you know what they say about her, don't you? The idea being, oh, that she was a lesbian. And he said, well, I don't really think that's any of our business. And she said, oh, the world today, what is coming to now? My son's going to be a priest. And then he said, is he a homo? Once he told a story about, I guess, a kid in the neighborhood who had, or a teenager who had, you know, beaten his car with a pipe and damaged it, vandalized his car. And I think he, you know, called the cops and they looked around and they found the kid, but the kid said, you know, I don't know what you're talking about. I've never seen your car before. I don't know what this is all about. And so they talked in the station house and then they were almost done. And my grandfather said to him, okay, you win.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
I think we might be having a problem with the recording.
Oh, okay.
I'm not... I think...
Yeah.
Let me see.
Well, why don't you stop it?